The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. In the northernmost region of Abiyala, in the land currently referred to as Canada, some people who use drugs have a legal, medicalized option for obtaining a safer supply of drugs. That's legal as in authorized by federal, provincial, and local governments. While the programs fall short in some important ways, which, by the way, the organization National Safer Supply Community of Practice fully acknowledges, it's the reason they use the term safer supply in the name rather than safe supply. While these programs fall short, they still provide much-needed services to populations that otherwise are often marginalized and neglected. Parkdale Queen West Community Health Center in Toronto, Ontario, is a participant in the Safer Supply Community of Practice. Its Safer Supply program has been undergoing an evaluation. The final report was released recently. The Community of Practice organization held an event to discuss the results, and we're going to hear a little from that on today's show. But first, turning to this part of northern Abiyala that's currently referred to as United States, there are a few bills we've been following in state legislatures this session, and I've got a few updates. In Colorado, legislation to allow overdose prevention sites, otherwise known as safe consumption sites, HB 23-1202, has fallen short. To be more specific, it's been postponed indefinitely. That's the bad news out of Colorado. The good news is that a so-called drug-induced homicide bill, SB 23-109, has also failed. Again, more precisely, it too has been postponed indefinitely. In Maine, legislation to allow local communities to establish an overdose prevention site, LD 1159, has stalled. But now in Oregon, some good news. On Monday, May 8th, legislation to expand and enhance harm reduction services in the state, HB 2395-A, was approved by that state legislature's Senate Committee on Healthcare and will advance to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. In that same hearing, the committee also approved a legislative package to enhance and support Measure 110 implementation. HB 2513A also goes to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Turning back to that Colorado bill on drug-induced homicide that failed, SB 23-109, the final hearing on that measure was held May 5th before the House Judiciary Committee. Let's hear from some of the witnesses. The next voice you hear will be that of Dr. Don Stater, Executive Director of the Colorado nonprofit, the Naloxone Project.
I am speaking in strong opposition to Senate Bill 23-109. By background, I'm an addiction and emergency medicine physician. I'm also the Executive Director of the Naloxone Project. I spend full time working with people in the substance use space. I'm coming off a 24-hour shift where I did a part-time addiction medicine clinic in a rural community. This is what I've dedicated my heart, my soul, and my career to. And we cannot incarcerate people like Raquel Garcia, which is what this law purports to not do, but would in action do. This is not a new experiment. Drug-induced homicide laws have existed for 30 years. We have tons of data that say that they do not work and they do not do what they're supposed to do. Instead of incarcerating high-level dealers, we instead incarcerate friends and family, and we compound the misery already done by a drug overdose. So don't be not mistaken, this is going to cost lives. It's going to cost lives because this is going to further eviscerate Good Samaritan laws, and more people are going to be scared to call 911 when a person does suffer an overdose. And what that will do is that will turn non-fatal overdoses into fatal overdoses. And then secondly, this is going to cost lives because we're going to put people in prison. And while that doesn't show up on a fatality sheet, that is costing someone their life. And when you look at the public health aspects of this, addiction is either a medical condition or it's not. So if we decide to incarcerate instead of treat people, what we're doing is changing something that costs $6,000 to get people treatment and return them to communities, return them to families, or we can spend $55,000 incarcerating them for 25 years to life and getting nothing but cost for our communities. I beseech you, all of you, as legislators, there's a right choice here. And the right choice is to double down on treatment and to ignore the desire for vengeance, because this isn't justice, this is vengeance.
Thank you.
And I beseech you to do a choice.
My name is Matt Pagnotti, and I'm the State and Local Government Relations Director for Vivint Health, a nonprofit provider of integrated HIV prevention and care, serving over 2,000 Coloradans each year. We proudly provide life-saving harm reduction services through our LifePoint program, including syringe access, naloxone test distribution, and supportive service referrals. Our organization is deeply concerned about the harm that Senate Bill 109 will cause to our efforts and those we serve. We stand in strong opposition to this bill, along with Colorado organizations and individuals responding to HIV/AIDS, or CORA, of which we are a member. In state after state, drug-induced homicide laws like SB 109 have proven to be ineffective at best and outright dangerous at worst. These laws mostly target low-level dealers or the friends and families of overdose victims, not kingpins. Most who are charged use drugs themselves and are disproportionately people of color. Worse still, drug-induced homicide laws discourage people from calling for help when an overdose occurs, costing additional lives. Our LifePoint participants frequently tell us they're afraid to call 911 and risk being arrested. They worry about losing their job or their housing or health care, so they rely on each other for help instead. SB 109 will only exacerbate this problem and lead to more preventable overdose deaths. The narrow carve-outs that were added do not reflect the actual experiences of those that we serve or address fears of arrest. And it's also both unrealistic and unfair to expect people to decipher complex legal provisions when witnessing a traumatic overdose. Our organization also offers LifePoint programs throughout the state of Wisconsin, which is a national leader in DIH charges. Out of hundreds of charges that are filed there each year, only a small handful are ever brought against high-level dealers. So understandably, many of our Wisconsin participants also fear calling for help due to that law. In short, SB 109 is clearly the wrong approach for Colorado. We urge the committee to vote no and invest instead in the evidence-based public health solutions that we know will truly save lives.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Botello. I'm here officially representing the Colorado Public Health Association as the past president and the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition as the equity and community development manager. I'm also here as the father of an adult child, 3 years into active recovery. And like many of you, I'm just another individual deeply and personally impacted by a public safety and public health crisis, which has inflamed our passions and bolstered our commitment to find a viable solution. But a growing body of research continues to make it very clear that solutions for reducing drug use and crime are not equal in their effectiveness. In 2017, the Pew Charitable Trust released an analysis of publicly available data from federal and state law enforcement, corrections, and health agencies. Their findings revealed no statistically significant relationship between drug imprisonment rates and drug use, drug overdose deaths, or drug arrests. These results were consistent with robust prior data, including a 2014 National Research Council report that challenges and disrupts the theory of deterrence, or the notion that tougher tactics and mandatory or lengthy prison terms discourage and reduce drug law violations. Stated plainly, harsher drug laws and higher rates of incarceration do not translate into lower rates of drug use arrests or overdose deaths. And moreover, as you have already heard, some measures, such as drug-induced homicide laws, are not merely ineffective, but can exacerbate the problem further by imposing additional disconnection, criminalization, and isolation upon already marginalized individuals and communities. 20 years of research demonstrates that these laws, in fact, cause more overdose deaths, not less. It's for these reasons that state lawmakers across the U.S. have embarked upon a new path by investing in innovative law enforcement, sentencing, treatment, public health, and prevention strategies that are actually effective.
Thank
Colorado
you.
Should follow suit. Thanks.
My name is Brian Adenoff. I'm an addiction psychiatrist, neuroscientist, and clinical professor at CU Anschutz. I'm here representing the Colorado Psychiatric Society, which opposes SB 109. Prior to moving to Colorado, upon retirement from full-time academia in 2018, I was the Distinguished Professor of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Research at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, and for over 30 years, I was a physician in the Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm going to dispense with my prepared comments in light of what I've been hearing in the presentation of this bill. Apparently, it's targeted at high-level drug dealers, but there's really nothing in the bill to suggest that that is the target. Yeah, I was in Vienna 2 months ago. I was invited to give a presentation at the UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs. And it was a week there. It was eye-opening. And the chair of the commission started the plenary by saying, much to my surprise, that the drug war that they have been complicit in fact, heading it around the world has resulted in trillions, billions, if not trillions of dollars being spent on interdiction, tens or hundreds of thousands of people being incarcerated, tremendous cost to people's lives, and the amount of drugs being used around the world and produced has only grown every year. It's clearly not working. And what we saw here in Colorado was a fentanyl bill a year ago that was going to be a targeted bill. And now there is a fundamental difference that's seen as a problem. And now we need another bill. It's just the beginning. We could see the slippery slope. Thank you.
My name is Valerie Collins. I'm an attorney and a Colorado-based nonprofit, but I'm not here to speak as an attorney. I'm here as one of the many members of our communities whose family has been devastated by substance use disorder. Several years ago, my spouse and my father-in-law found the dead body of my sister-in-law. She overdosed on heroin in her apartment soon after celebrating her 14th month sober anniversary. We found a man's coat in her apartment when we found her body. We never learned whose coat it was, but we've always suspected that it could have been the person who she was using with. That's an unanswered question that my family lives with every day. That what if that person felt empowered to call for help? What if that person had Narcan? What if she didn't have to die? I'm here today because I do not want other families to have to live with that question. There's no denying that this bill will increase overdose deaths, impose severe punishments on grieving loved ones, and will have no impact on drug use and drug selling. We know this. The data is there. It just is. It's a fact. You have public policy, criminal law, medical experts coming out of the woodwork to explain why this bill has no support. That is because creating an even larger barrier between people and the treatment that they need is simply terrible policy. I know that legislators are under intense pressure to do something to impact this epidemic, but this is not it. We can do better. Please do not place this pain on more families. Please vote no.
My name is Morgan Godwin, and I'm a researcher and overdose prevention specialist. But had I been sentenced under the law before you today, I could still be in prison. By my mid-20s, I'd been addicted to heroin for many years, side by side with my best friend, Justin DeLong. And we always tried to take care of each other and had a profound and loving friendship despite our struggles. My mom, a disabled veteran, died of an accidental prescription drug overdose. The life insurance payment meant that I could buy copious amounts of heroin, though it brought me no solace. One night in 2014, Justin texted me asking me for a favor. He wanted a gram of heroin, and I obliged. I was purchasing quarter ounces at a time, which meant I had a gram to spare. He came to my apartment, handed me $80, and I handed him 1 gram. He apologized for not making it to my mom's funeral and gave me one of his famous hugs. He overdosed alone in his bedroom that night. I wasn't there to save him like he had saved me so many times. I sold him a gram of heroin because he asked me to, because he would be sick without it, because he had done the same for me countless times. I was arrested for drug delivery resulting in death federally and faced a 20-year mandatory minimum sentence. I faced a steeper penalty for selling him a gram upon his request than I would have if I intentionally assaulted him and caused permanent bodily injury. But no matter, we know that increasing the severity of punishment does not deter crime. White privilege and dumb luck meant that I got sentenced a plea deal for 5 years. Since Justin died, the overdose rate has only increased exponentially. I have lost more people. Putting me in prison didn't prevent anyone's death then, and passing this law won't prevent anyone's death now. Who will this law put in prison? It's not really abstract or up for debate. It's not a cartoonish caricature of evil drug dealers. It's people like me.
You just heard Morgan Godvin, a researcher and overdose prevention specialist. Valerie Collins, a Colorado attorney. Dr. Brian Adenoff, clinical professor of psychiatry at CU Anschutz. Jason Vitello, equity and community development manager with the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. Matt Bagnotti, state and local government relations director at Vivant Health. And that segment started with Don Stater, MD, executive director of the Naloxone Project. They all testified May 5th before the Colorado Legislature's House Judiciary Committee in opposition to SB 23-109, a drug-induced homicide measure. That measure has been indefinitely postponed. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, turning to Canada and Safer Supply. The National Safer Supply Community of Practice held an event recently to release the results of the final evaluation report of Parkdale Queen West Community Health Center's Safer Supply Program. Here's Paul Colosimo, case manager for Parkdale's Safer Opioid Supply Program, and Kate Atkinson, the program's project manager.
Hi, everyone. My name is Paul Colosimo. I'm a case manager in the Parkdale Queen West Community Health Center Safer Opioid Supply Program.
My name is Kate Atkinson, and I am the project manager in the SOS program at Parkdale Queen West.
So primary care providers at Parkdale Queen West Community Health Center started offering safe opioid supply in 2019 under shared guidelines at that point in time. 2020 saw funding from Health Canada's Substance Use and Addictions Program alongside the Downtown East Collaborative SOS in Toronto, which then eventually moved to a supportive model led by a team of nurses and nurse practitioners who work full-time at each health center. The clinical teams provide consistent care and safe monitoring with long-term care planning suited to the unique needs of individuals receiving safe opioid supply. Parkdale Queen West Community Health Center worked from two base sites, with SOS programming stretching across both sites, possessing a team of two nurse practitioners, four registered nurses, and two case managers divided equally between sites. Counseling services are offered to the clients, with the counselor working across both sites, and a management team consisting of one supervisor, a project manager, and an SOS program manager. Our client advisory committee has 7 to 8 members who offer observations and suggestions for improvements of service provision. The committee is a collaboration of individuals currently accessing SOS services and members of the program's team. So as of this past December 31st, 2022, there was a total of 86 active clients receiving safer opioid supply at Parkdale Queen West Community Health Center. 40% were women, 53% were men, 7% were trans, non-binary, two-spirit identified, 22% were Indigenous, and 58% were white. Our SOS program has committed to using 4 objectives as a primary focus for our service provision, along with creating transparency with funders of our goals as a program. The first objective is to reduce the risk of overdose and deaths by providing adults exposed to the contaminated illegal drug supply with low barrier access to a safer drug supply. 2 is to respond quickly to the ongoing overdose crisis by implementing and evaluating a low barrier, community-based safer supply model that can be delivered by primary care providers with minimal resources. 3 is to engage participants who face barriers to accessing traditional models of primary care and harm reduction, stabilizing healthcare, and comprehensive care services. And 4 is to reduce harms associated with illegal activities required to access drugs through the illicit market.
To carry out the evaluation, we used a few different tools. We conducted a baseline survey with people who had started in the program within the last 4 weeks. And there was a relatively small response rate, as you can see from here. But it does represent about a third of the clients who joined the program last year. And then there was an ongoing care survey, and that was given to anybody who had been in the program for at least six months. And there was a little bit higher response rate in that group, about a third of the active clients at that time. And then I also carried out 15 more in-depth interviews with clients, including making sure that there was robust representation of women and non-binary trans and Indigenous clients, so that comes through well, like those experiences come through well in the data. And then finally, there's the electronic medical record just to get some program statistics. So Paul just had talked about a second ago about those kind of four objectives. And those objectives were things that we put forward in the pilot version of the program, objectives that we wanted to meet. And so they form the kind of backbone of the evaluation. They form the framework that we asked of the questions that we asked. So to start with, we looked at the reduction in risk of overdose and deaths, providing access to a safer drug supply. And this client in their interview said, when I started the program, I was on fentanyl, a lot of fentanyl, and I was at the point of overdosing all the time. I didn't want to die. So they offered me the program and I went, yes. She said, you're a candidate. Would you like to? And I started to cry. I needed something to keep me alive. I started the program there. And this quotation reflects the experience of many clients who are coming into the program who are really looking for something that will support them and give them an option to keep themselves alive.
That was Kate Atkinson, project manager for the Parkdale Queen West Community Health Center's Safer Opioid Supply Program, and Paul Colosimo, case manager for the program, presenting results from a final evaluation report on that program. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Another participant in this panel was Ashley Smoke, capacity building lead with the Women and HIV/AIDS Initiative of Ontario. Let's hear some of their thoughts.
Yeah, and in terms of DCRIM, I really feel like it should also be not constricted by amounts. Like, I know in BC that their threshold is 2.5 grams. And people don't buy 2.5 grams of drugs. They buy 3.5 grams of drugs. Like, everyone knows this, but they do it purposefully so they can recriminalize us. So I think we need to have people who use drugs be part of that conversation a lot more and actually be heard on that. And then, so in terms of harm reduction programming and these kinds of programming, it's so important to have really good relationships. And you don't know that when you go to work that day, what kind of impact you're going to have on that person who uses drugs and how your job is going to then impact their lives outside of the service. But your interactions, having that rapport will help impact people who use drugs. And it could be good or bad. You could play a pivotal role in a person's life, or you could be the person who ruins healthcare for them. So it's really important and it's a big responsibility to be non-judgmental and help improve the lives of people who use drugs by taking it slow and having reciprocal relationships, because that way you can really change someone's life and improve their health just by being there and not then sticking with them through all those things. And then we all know safer supply is life-saving, but it helps folks get their lives figured out. And I think we focus a lot on the life-saving aspects, but there's so many more things that happen in a person who uses drugs' lives once they're on safer supply. It helps them not have to be dependent on the street supply, which is amazing because the benzos are really bad right now. It helps people keep their tolerance at a certain level and helps them gauge their use and taper their drug use on their own. it also helps them stop using, and they can use, or those who stop using and use occasionally overdose and they risk death. So it not only reduces the risk of overdose, but it also improves the well-being of the person who's on the program. It's important that we expand Safer Supply and like use it as much as we can in the community. Access to a healthcare provider, it also increases all areas of health in their life, like their quality of life. But like, it's so important to have like wraparound care too, and like warm referrals, like Kate mentioned, counseling. I used to have counseling at a program and then they decided to take it away just because of like financial reasons. And it disrupted my whole life. And like if I wasn't in the position I was, I would have definitely like spiraled. But I think like we don't understand what kind of impact those financial decisions have on the people who are attending the service. So just wanted to mention that. Parkdale Queen West has a counselor, but they're so busy and I feel like there's such a need. So expanding like that aspect and like case management, I think is really important for next steps. We also, I noticed that at Parkdale Queen West, they go above and beyond to get you like the care you need, no matter where it is or what it happens to be. And they ensure that clients are like supported in all areas of their life. And that holistic approach, I think, is why the program is so successful. And the case management, they work like in a variety of areas. There's a specialized one for like people who have CAS involvement or court involvement. So I think like having those other parts in the community health center and having all those programs and services accessible to the Safer Supply clients is really beneficial. What needs to be improved, though, I think, is like transitions for people in and out of the hospital. I know, like, for me, it's not easy getting admitted to the hospital. So trying to make those transitions more seamless, because we like have a lot of health issues and we often like go to the hospital for so many things. So, yeah, it's nice to have like more protocols around that, maybe.
That was Ashley Smoke, Capacity Building Lead with the Women in HIV/AIDS Initiative of Ontario. They were speaking on the release of the final evaluation report for Parkdale Queen West Community Health Center's Safer Opioid Supply Program. That event was sponsored by the National Safer Supply Community of Practice. They do a lot of really great work and have some tremendous resources available through their website, which is nss-aps.ca. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.